Sunshine Meets on Dublin's easy place to relax.
Sunshine 106.8.
And welcome along to Sunshine Meets. This evening, my special guest is Pat Short. Thanks for dropping in, Pat.
Oh, listen, good to see you. Thank you very much for having me.
So, you've had a really interesting life and you're well known from TV, you're well known from your comedy. But before we get into all that, tell us a little bit about your early life, your family growing up and where you're from.
Well, I grew up in Thurleston, Tipperary, and I suppose it was a big family, 11 children in the family, and but it was 8 boys and 4 girls, and 8, 9, 10, 11, that's 12. I actually had a stepsister comes along later on, but when I grew up, it was 11. So I'm kind of used to saying 8 and 4, but it was like 8 and the 3 girls at the time. So yeah, so it's heavily influenced by music in the family. My dad was a fiddle player. My mum died when we were very young, but she was a piano player herself as well. So we all played music at one time or another. So it was a kind of a big part of growing up. We were in the brass band, played in the brass band for years, and then the girls would have been in the orchestra in this convent, and we all played music and different, you know. My brother plays, still to this day, plays banjo, great banjo player and traditional music, because my dad was a traditional fiddle player. So that was kind of where the influence came on the music front.
When did you start to get into
music? Well, I always played music. From the age of about 6, I started playing piano. And then I went on to concert flute around 9, 10, around there, 11. And I played Tin Whistle, kind of traditional music, and Tin Whistle and flute. And then around the age of 15, I picked up saxophone. There was a couple of saxophones in the house. My dad played sax. My granduncle played sax in London. And there was an alto sax that he's lying around the house. So I picked that up and started playing. And I suppose...
Were you self-taught?
Yeah, I was to a degree, but I had a year with a teacher down in Limerick. He was a jazz saxophone player, so I used to listen to a lot of jazz. He influenced me a lot in how to, you know, scales and all that kind of stuff. I had kind of grown up learning scales at piano. That was the big thing with piano. So when any instrument I pick up, I'd apply the same
principle to it. Saxophone, we have our own Paddy Cole that does a show here in the Sunday morning.
Paddy,
who celebrated his 80th birthday recently, is still playing the sax.
Yeah.
And I was thinking, there has to be a certain type of skill of how you control your breathing to be able to do that.
There is, but I don't know how to do it. Well, I mean, there isn't. You know, I mean, the circular breathing, there's all sorts of different techniques. There is techniques you learn when you start playing an instrument, holding a note for long periods of time, stuff like that. It helps you. It's like any muscle, isn't it? You know, it helps you with your lungs and that. And the one thing I found, even recently, I hadn't played the sax for a while, for years. I'd pick it up every so often, but I started black playing with a blues band recently, and I got a bit of asthma when I gave up the cigarettes around when I was about 5 or so. And recently, for the last couple of years, when I've been playing the sax, my breathing is perfect. I do that. You know, you go for your test once a year to the specialist on NASPA, and you have to do a blow thing, and he couldn't believe how my blowing had gone so good. So it's all down to playing the saxophone. And it's like any muscle if you're walking or you're just exercising.
So
a beautiful instrument.
School in Tipperary and Thurleston, how did that go? Primary, secondary, when did you leave?
God, I went to every school in the place. Well, I get it. I started in the convent as a very young primary, then moved up to the Christian Brothers in primary. But then my dad was a principal of a primary school out in Moyne Temple Tui. So all of us as kids went out there, you know. Okay. So to school, some for like 5th and 6th year, went out there. Then came back into the CBS in Turles. So went there for a couple of years. And that's the thing, we did a load of brothers, and I was going to the CBS. And some of the younger guys were more technically minded, so they went up to the vocational school because they had metalwork up there and stuff like that. The boys went on to be engineers after, and that kind of thing. So I was in brothers on my own, because my older brothers than me were more kind of academic. So they were in the CBS, that was kind of traditional, but the other lads wanted to go to the other school. So I found myself then in fifth year going, geez, I'm not sitting down here on my own, I'll go put the boys up to the tech, you know. So I went up and joined the lads up there in the vocation school, and ended up doing my leaving cert up there. So
And did you find tech versus kind of secondary school that you were more skilled going into the world, or?
I don't know, I I wasn't terribly mad about the Christian Brothers, or something about the Brothers I wasn't wild about. Lots of people probably say I agree. And I just found the vocation school just a bit more kind of free, more kind of, you know, they were just more kind of relaxed kind of atmosphere there, you know what I mean? And a great atmosphere. And then there was a more kind of academic, more kind of, you know, building construction technology, as it would be called now and stuff. And subjects like that, which I was kind of more leaning towards, you know, and then good arts, art teachers there and stuff like that up there. And that was kind of more the area I was kind of interested in, you know, and writing and English and that kind of stuff. So, yeah, I kind of really enjoyed vocational school, I have to say, the last couple of years there.
What stage then did you sort of gravitate towards the entertainment world versus what sort of job did you do when you left?
Well, I never had a job in my life. I was always into music and bands, and I knew I couldn't go to music college because I didn't have the grades and stuff like that. And it was at the time you had to have a certain amount of grades or play two instruments. I did play two instruments, but I wasn't competent enough on them. I did do music for a year. I just was very lost in it, but I always wanted to play music. So I'd been playing with bands. When I was in Leaving Cert, I used to go down to this music teacher in Limerick, and the Shannon Jasmine used to play in the Grand Arena. I used to go up and play with them, and very, you know, I had an awful cheek. I'd walk into a session with a saxophone, say, any chance I can play a tune? They get up, and then I was good. So they'd always ask me to stay on and invite me back. So I kind of, whether it be in Cork or Limerick or anywhere, I was playing with a lot of jazz heads and getting up and jumping up and playing with them in sessions and blues bands. I had a blues band I was playing with in Turles. So I went to art college in Limerick, but I knew I kind of was, that was kind of only a bridge for me to kind of really find out.
Go into the creative
the
world.
Music.
Yeah, music. Yeah,
and
yeah.
I was good at art, and I enjoyed the year in college, but that's when I met John Kenny and we ended up playing music.
So did your dad have any issues with you going into, you know, like a world that's quite difficult to make a living?
I know, not really. I mean, he was quite open like that. I mean, in his own way, he was an academic himself. He's a principal of a school, but he was very driven by college and all that kind of stuff. Wanted every one of us to do that. But music was the big thing with him, and he'd played for years. When he was younger, he was in UCC before he went up to St. Pat's in Dublin, and he had played with Sean O'Riordan and his band and various people like that, and then he'd run the Oireachtas numerous years when he was up in St. Pat's as a primary school student in Dublin, and he'd been playing a lot with Ona Sulawal and various other musicians like that. Okay. So he'd been in the world of gigging even right. when we were some younger. He was to make, because the teacher's salary wouldn't have been great, he was still gigging at weekends himself, so he kind of knew the world.
Well, that was the world of civil service, was it? People working in civil service, and they transitioned into the
other areas and things like that. Yeah, so, and it was that's what that time was like. People in his year in college was Sean O'Shea, musician.
Wow,
singer,
okay. So he certainly
John
mixed
McGarren,
with the,
people like that. So he knew people in that lived and worked in the arts world. And when he saw me going for it, he said, yeah, go for what you like doing. Well, yeah, he's right.
I want to talk to you about your transition from being a musician into doing comedy, because, you know, it fascinates me a bit. Like, you know, I remember Brendan Grace was kind of playing in a ballet group, and then suddenly he became known as a comedian, and people kind of forgotten that he could actually sing and play and stuff like that. But before I do that, I want to ask you about, because we always ask our guests to choose a little bit of music that may have influenced them or something that they, you know, particularly like. So do you have any particular song?
Well, I suppose I'd have to say I grew up playing brass instruments, saxophones, trumpets, cornets, all that. And when I was young, for ska was very much a big part of the music scene. There was various different heavy metal, ska, madness, Naughty Boys, wanting. We were kind of, I was more into the Rude Boy kind of scene, which was the Specials and the Beat and that kind of way. And I think one of the first bands I really loved because of the saxophone was the Beat. Mirror in the Bathroom was the tune I remember they played.
Okay, we'll do that. This is the Beat and Mirror in the Bathroom.
Sunshine Meets on Dublin's easy place to relax.
Sunshine 106.8.
And you're very welcome back to Sunshine Meets. My guest this Sunday evening is Pat Short. Great to have you here, Pat. And I certainly enjoy that little bit of music there. I presume it brought you
jumping around the room.
I presume it brought you back to the days, yeah.
Yeah, I always have this memory of like a very old vinyl record player in the house between the whole gang of us and fighting over who put on what, you know.
Yeah.
That was the way it was with a big gang of teenagers in the house. But yeah, the Beat was a big, the Specials, all those, the Selector, all those type of music and bands jumping around.
Did you do any gigs in Dublin at that stage?
Well, funny enough, I started working with John and I was doing...
Where did you meet John, by the way?
I was in... A brother of mine is a photographer, Tom, and he was very friendly with John through Theatre Omnibus. And when John went out on his own, then Tom did a lot of photography for John. And they were mates, and Tom was living and teaching in Limerick at the time, in teaching art in Skullcarmel. And he was living in Turles, and I remember John came to visit Tom and Turles and spend the night, John and Marge and Tom and Val. And we were gigging with a band. The Scratch Machine was the band at the time, up the town in a pub. So John came up and jumped up and had a session with us, and we had a great night. We had absolute madness. So we kind of kept in touch. I went to art college then in Limerick, and John used to do a residency in Costello's Bar in Limerick every Wednesday night. So yeah, invited me down with the saxophone to get up and play a tune and have a bit of crack. So I used to do that. And then as things with John always progressed into madness, and it ended up being a tune to stripping off to your jocks and doing a whole sketch about the seaside and playing Summertime. You know what I mean? So it evolved into... So I started kind of touring with John that Christmas while I was still in college. And then when I left the following June, July, I went full-time with John on the road doing sound and lights and stuff like that. So we used to gig all over the place.
When you're saying you were kind of accompanying him and setting up
and doing the sound and lights. Well, I mean, yeah, I remember doing the Baggot Inn back in the day upstairs in the kind of small venue in the Baggot, not the big room out the back. The Lower Deck in Dublin, we used to do that. There's loads of small places around Dublin we used to play. Of course, eventually we went on to do the Bale Bucked, which that's gone now. Yeah, it used to be there at Leeson Bridge, not Leeson Bridge, the one up for the...
Charlemont, is it?
Yeah. Yeah, there's a block of apartments there now.
I know.
But it was one of the first pub theatres in Dublin that was doing... They had a little room out the back. God, we could fit maybe 60 into it or something like that. And that's where kind of the Unbelievables started.
So tell us about... I mean, when you were gigging with John, I'm guessing when you said it descended into madness, you both maybe told jokes or did some stuff, or
John was kind of telling jokes and doing songs and music, and that's where I came in playing sax accompaniment on the music. But then it turned into a sketch, and we started doing the characters. Like, John would start taking the piss out of me and my character. I would then be a character that would kind of take it and the butt end of the joke. So this kind of straight man, funny man routine evolved.
Okay.
Kind of organically in a way.
So this wasn't scripted or anything?
No.
This was just... Yeah.
Just ad-libbing and having a crack after a tune. Then we got to the stage where we said, look, we were enjoying it. It was going well. It was great fun. And we thought we should start putting more of a structure to it and script it.
Wasn't disciplined and it could have gone on too long or too short.
Exactly. So it was a case of... And then we thought we'd put costumes to it and maybe do entrance exits and create different sketches and characters. And that's kind of how it came about. It took a couple of years to get to that stage.
And Dunbelievables, of course, I've seen them, you know, many venues and I think at the Bord Gáis. But at what stage did you get a sense that there was something happening as you went around the country?
I don't know. It was strange. We'd been doing a lot of work in America and in New York and that was going really well for us, and we were planning to move over there, and we got a break on the Late Late Show and we went into Andrews Lane after, and that's when it just sold out and took off. And it just progressed after that. Gay Byrne loved us, and he used to talk about us on his show, and just the audiences then, he had the power of radio that had sold out everything. And that's kind of what we knew. But the one thing about us, we were very hard workers in the sense that we used to just plow on gigging, writing new material, putting new shows together, doing stuff, making videos. And we didn't stop to think about it, even though it was selling out everywhere and we were doing long runs in theatres and everything. But we just kind of kept plowing away at it.
I remember at the time John Kenny got sick and you guys stopped for a while.
We finished up all together working then that way. We didn't really... We did a reunion tour about 10 years ago, but we... That was in 1999, 2000.
Wow. Okay.
John got ill and we stopped working. He couldn't work for a couple of years, you know, and I had to go on and start keep working. So I started doing solo career, and I think we were going our separate ways anyway at that stage.
You felt we
had done as much as we wanted to do together, and if John hadn't got sick that year, I think we would have probably split
fizzle
up.
Fizzle out anyway,
gone. Yeah. I think we would have gone our own separate ways anyway. Yeah. So that's kind of, it kind of happened for us, unfortunately for John. But he picked himself up again after it and came
amazing,
back
I know.
Him.
Yeah, amazing, yeah.
He's flying it again.
And then you sort of start doing a bit of television work. And did you find that daunting?
Well, it was kind of after doing the Unbelievables videos, I got a real taste for TV filming and that kind of stuff. And I'd done quite a lot of movies. So I was approached by RT at the time in 2001, I think it was, would I be interested in doing a TV show and putting an idea together and working with them on it. So I kind of said no at the start because I found it a bit daunting. But then I sat down to think about it and I worked on it and thought about some of the stuff I'd done with The Unbelievables and how it worked out. So I went back with a pitch with an idea for a village and a whole place, and we put together Kill the Scully. Yeah. And the first pilot episode of it did nearly 800,000 viewers.
I know, it was phenomenal. Fantastic.
790 something thousand, I think was the number. And that's when they went to the show after.
Was that hard work
yeah,
for you?
It was. I mean, I talked about it recently to somebody. I'd spent 10 years doing Kill the Scully and Matty, the two series of Matty and six or seven of Kill the Scully. And the way it would work is you'd kind of start writing and pitching and putting the idea to RT. You were never sure if they're going to take it.
So did you have an independent company that it wasn't RT?
Yeah. Gable & Media. We were down in Limerick and we'd studios and edit rooms and all that down there. And we'd start a pitch and ideas. You'd get the scripts. You'd start running with the scripts. You'd have script editor with you. You'd be trying to write and get it all done up until about March, April. And then you go into pre-production, which is be building sets, getting all the crews, hiring all the people to come together. They'd all land, be there for about a month before the cast would arrive and we'd have the sets done.
And who did all the financial end of this? I mean, to make sure that this...
I had a whole team working with me below in the office in Limerick. You know what I mean? I had producers and financial people and accountants and everything. And
to make sure that you make a few bob out of it.
Well, you've got a budget and you've got to make the money, you've got to make a profit out of it, and you've got to also not go over budget, which is a big thing. It could easily happen and you've got to, you know, be careful not to do that and have... contingency plans and all that together. So it was a huge project, and we'd work away, and then the cast would be gone after filming for 3 months, and I'd be there for another month or two with the director doing all the editing and everything, getting the sound all that right and everything. And then we'd deliver to RT in August, and then you'd be looking at literally working on another year.
Did they make any sort of, would they make a commitment to it if they saw bits of it, or?
They loved it, but of course the big thing is, did the audiences love it? So it had to go out in air and see, and then you really wouldn't get a confirmation from the channel unless the audiences were there, and they were there every year consistently, and they built. We'd won Christmas, we'd over 1 million viewers for our Christmas special, so it was a huge production. It kind of ran a cycle every 12 months, and I was touring in between all this and doing movies as well, so I was nearly exhausted after 10 years of doing that.
And did you feel like you had to take everything in case you know?
Yeah, of course, we're all freelancers.
Well, I've meant in the sense of, I better take this because if I turn that down,
there'll be nothing there next year. Yeah, there'll be an empty ball. You think like that, but of course, you know, you always make do, you know.
And tell us, the movies, just for people who don't know, the example of some of the movies you were in.
Well, my very first movie I did was Angela Mooney Dies Again, with Mia Farrow, Brendan Gleeson and Patrick Bergen, and that was very, very early days. Then I went on to do Garage a number of years later with Lenny Abramson, and that kind of turned things around for me, in the sense that people saw me as a serious actor.
Did you have to audition for that? Did you hear about
I had worked with Lenny on a few projects before that, and we knew each other, and they had it written with me in mind to come and do it, and they always approached me from the start, said, look, this is the film, this is the character, we'd love you to do it, and we'd be writing it with you in mind. And that's how it happened. And that changed things a lot for me, in because it was a very serious role, and people saw me then for not just being a comic but a serious actor. So, you know, I'd done Father Ted prior to that. I'd done a huge amount. That was all comedy, which was great, really, really good. And then I've done a lot of other films since. I got to work with great directors like John Borman, people like that, you know, and Richard E. Grant and all them on film recently. And, you know, so it's I Dark Lies the Island, another film I did recently. There's been quite a lot of movies over the last number of years. I can barely remember half the names, but they've been great, you know. So I've had a very, very good film career as well as stage.
Brilliant. Well, look, we're going to take a pause because I want to talk to you about where you're at today. I know you have a podcast going ahead, you know, you have shows going, you have all that sort of stuff. But before we do, we'll take a second break and you'll give us another song, Pat.
Well, I'm going to be very diverse now what I'm going to give you. And again, if you want to jump around the place and like, I know the ska and the things was when I was younger. Then you get older, you get more mellow, more into party mode. And I always think the best party tune of all, an Irish tune, the Nolan Sisters, and I'm in the Mood for Dancing.
Lovely stuff. The Nolans, here we go. I'm in the Mood for Dancing.
Sunshine Meets on Dublin's Easy Place to Relax.
Sunshine 106.8.
And welcome back. You're listening to Sunshine Meets. We're with Pat Short this Sunday evening.
He's sweating now after that.
The Nolans. Do you know what that reminds me of? The BBC and Val Doonigans all that time. And I was just thinking about when you were talking earlier on about, you know, the power of Gayburn and the Larry Gogans and all these people. It's like this, you're sort of moving into the departure lounge when all these great people who you've known all your life and they're passing away, and you're saying to yourself, Marion Finucane and everything
it's
like
mad,
that.
It's mad, isn't it?
It is, and all the high profile people. And you know, I'm trying to think, you have the Ryan Tubridys and the Graham Nortons and stuff like
next.
That.
Is that what you're saying, is it?
No, what I'm saying is that, you know, these other people had such a huge influence, and then you're saying to yourself, I am getting old, old, you know. Anyway, the Nolans, I'm in the Mood for Dancing. And
I remember John Kenny telling me one time, he played support him in the Olympia, and he said just before he came, as he was coming off, they were lined up to get on, and their mother was blessing him with holy water.
And I know you've been asked this question many times, but I'm always fascinated about where you draw your various characters from, you know.
Well, I suppose, I think when it comes to comedy or any writing, that you always draw from your childhood memories and characters. And of course, then it's about how you twist and exaggerate that for comic reasons. But, you know, it's whether it's a guy standing on the street directing traffic during the novena that you then turns into a character that's struggling for power and take over the town, you know, which is complete madness. But that's the kind of way you start. You pick on a small.
Well, it's
like
just when you talk about those things. And I remember many years ago when I started sort of DJing and I had a little gig down the country. And before we went in, the priest came in and then everyone did the rosary. And I'm from Dublin. I'd never, ever witnessed that. But I'm guessing it was kind of a normal thing nearly, you know.
I remember processions down in Turles. The May procession was huge when I was a kid. And you don't see it anymore. And if you saw a black and white movie of some village in Spain where they carried Our Lady on their shoulder or something, you'd say, God, that's mad stuff. I remember that in Turles as a kid, you know, and it was big pageantry and loads of priests. We'd priest training colleges in two of the biggest convents in the town. Mm-hmm. So you had clergy everywhere and it had a huge influence. And people used to set up, it must have been the May procession as well. Somebody would probably ring in and tell us about it. They used to put little shrines outside shops to Our Lady and stuff like that, outside the local chemist and shoe shops and everything. On those days, the parades would be up and down.
I remember thinking of the detail of Godfather 2 and the scene where before this, the big parade through with Our Lady and all the money being put on the statue.
Yes.
Did you see Godfather 2?
That's Godfather, wasn't it?
The second
scene.
One. Yeah. And this before the guy is going to assassinate something and the conflict between the gangsters and the church and the whole thing was like, but it was fascinating, and you talk about that as the various processions when in the 60s, 70s, I suppose.
70s,
when people were growing up and the power of the church. And nowadays, completely gone.
Completely gone.
Yeah, I guess. So, Pat, tell us, if someone goes along to the show, what can they expect?
Oh, God. I hope it'll be funny anyway, that's the one thing. I wish, look, there's loads of different characters, and I suppose every show needs a hook and a thread. Yeah. As I often say, my threads are very, very loose in my shows, but it kind of links the thing together. And what I loosely hang it on is a beauty pageant. Because I think, again, going back to when I was in Turles as a young fella, the Queen of the Plough was a big beauty pageant there every year. But the Market of Fermor one, I remember it every year was huge, and there'd be a big dance up in the Premier Hall in the town. That, so I kind of remember the pageantry that used to go along with it, and I do kind of recreate a bit of that in the hall.
Fantastic. And I know you're into talking about your podcast. Tell us about that.
It's a kind of a radio show based, it's based on a radio show. It's a sketch show where I play this character called Pear, and he does the wellness hour with Pear. and the beauty of it is it's not a full hour, it's only 18 minutes. So you have 42 minutes to yourself, you can relax and enjoy it. And then it's like there's all these different characters come on. There's a doctor and there's like contributors to a radio show, and they're all fairly mad characters, and they have their own sketch. So it's a great bit of madness for an hour, which is only 18 minutes long.
Do you take sort of breaks now at this stage, and without going too much into your personal life, but I mean to say, you know, have you made enough money to sort of say, well, I can take a few months off or not, you know?
No, is the answer to that. I've made it and got rid of it and lost it and made it again. No, what I do is not really about the money in the sense. It's great. You have to make a living. You've got kids, teenagers going to college, and they all want different things. So you're kind of working for all of that. But I like doing what I do, and it's the diversity in the work that I do, whether it be, I'm loving the podcast at the moment because I'm working back in the Art College in Limerick, working with a lot of students there on that, and we're putting it together and assembling it through the Art College with Simon McGuire, the lecturer there. And it's great. It's great fun. And I love collaborative work as well. A lot of time you're on your own in this business being a solo performer, so it's nice to get in and work with a team on something. And then I have a few films coming up in the summertime and that. So you take a break when you can, but the projects are so different that it's lovely to do it. I spend most of this summer filming. I have a TV show and a couple of films to do, and by the end of the summer into the new year, into the autumn, I have a new live show hopefully opening as well, so that'll keep me folks and
that's good. So you have a lot going forward into the future, which is always a positive thing.
Yes.
And I was thinking that, you know, you'd be thinking, now there's Pat Short, Unbelievables, movies, TV series. He must be worth the fortune. where is his yacht?
Just down in Killaloo.
Well, listen, it's been an absolute pleasure talking to you this Sunday evening. So
much.
I'm going to get a couple of songs, two more songs off you, and then we'll say goodnight. So give me just a couple of songs that you...
Well, again, you have me on the spot there. Two other songs that I would think of.
Well, anything you think about, in it, whether it be your past or something, you know, that you remember that maybe your dad played or something, jazz thing or anything. It doesn't matter. Or something that you say, God, I love that song.
Well, Don't Go Breaking My Heart with Elton John. That was a great tune. I remember my kind of childhood bopping away to that music. From a jazz perspective, anything by Chet Baker, Autumn Leaves, let's say. Yeah. I mean, he's just an amazing voice and trumpet. And that tune in particular was one of the first jazz tunes I learned. I loved it.
Yeah, okay. And you're still playing?
Still playing away, some blues festivals throughout the year with the band from Limerick, Gang was down there.
What do you call yourselves?
Well, we were known as the Fabulous Matthews. Which is a great name. It's the way people in Limerick pronounce Matthews. Fabulous Matthews. Yeah. A blues band myself and J.J. Hagerty put together many years ago.
And is it just that you do little residencies and stuff like that?
We do a lot of touring up around Donegal and up around the north and that. Yeah, just getting up to places where I don't actually normally play myself in the stage show. And we just, play some small blues bars and stuff like that.
Yeah, but that's what I was thinking. And if you come to Dublin, no one would go. They wouldn't know who you were.
Yeah, that's it.
Because I'm fascinated. What was it, that actor from Gladiator that had a little band and played? Russell Crowe comes over and played. And people say, is that Russell Crowe? And then there's other people who go along to see him just because no
interest in the music. Just go and see Russell Crowe.
So you get a lot of that. And I think many years ago in Bad Bobs, one of the former Eagle guys there, Bernie Layden, came to play, and everyone kept shouting about Hotel Calibur, and he was going bananas, you know. Going,
oh my God,
they were driving him mad, you know.
Because I guess the jumbo breakfast roll, that's what I can shout.
Well, listen, Pat Short, it's been an absolute pleasure, and thanks a million for coming in this Sunday.
Lovely stuff, thank you very much.
All right, cheers.